SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Monday. Race fans, Sirius 219 XM 201, Sports Zone 964. Listening to Sirius XM online and at our website as well, stevebick.com. Somehow the microphone was on my phone, and so every word being turned out, you stop that from recording. Somebody will get a message that'll be the preamble to the Declaration of Independence. What a weekend. What a fascinating and rewarding and satisfying, even if you didn't cash much, what can you say about the Preakness we were treated to? It was... With all the craziness and all the bobbing and weaving everybody had to do from, you know, the inside portion, from the racetrack organizations adjusting, and all of the horsemen and owners and riders and players and everybody. I mean, just everybody involved when it came to reworking this 2020 Triple Crown season. And in the aftermath here, and obviously it's not even 48 hours, but it's hard not to be pleased and impressed by the way everything came off. And there's so much more. That's the best part, is that you're going to take these results, and it's going to look like something, you know, one thing down the road, I suppose, when you look at those lists of Triple Crown seasons, and it's going to show, you know, 'Tis the Law, Authentic, and Swiss Skydiver, and who knows? You may be thinking about it in the same way we think about Street Sense, Curlin, and Rags to Riches, because I think it was hard not to be thinking about those, particularly that season, and whether it was Curlin and Street Sense and the Preakness, you know, given the involvement of the trainer jockey with Swiss Skydiver, with Kenny McPeak, who found Curlin, and Robbie Alborado, who rode him. And then, of course, you fold in the filly, and Street Sense and Hardspun became Curlin, and Street Sense became Curlin and Rags to Riches. So you had filly in a Triple Crown race. I mean, what else do we pine for than these kinds of moments? And there really was a lot of heavy-handed drama involved in this, you know, including the beginning of the week and, you know, the questions being asked about, you know, quote-unquote settling on Robbie Alborado to ride her. And those get answered emphatically, because Alborado, in addition to having the filly be ready and be a war horse, I mean, she's a throwback horse. I mean, they ran the Gallarette earlier in the day. She's, in her own way, a Gallarette-ish type. I mean, she's run two races against three-year-old boys. We'll see what's down the road, and we'll talk to Kenny in about 25 minutes, And we'll just, you know, kind of, it's easy to turn the mic over to Kenny, and he deserves tremendous credit. Kenny McPeak takes his share of, ribbing. You know, we have the long running curling gag. You know, Kenny picked her out, picked him out. that never gets tired. That's a perennial. But, you know, Ken tries things and he talks about somewhat outlandish plans or ideas, and you know, the tendency is, you know, to roll the eyes a little bit. And, okay, all right, yeah. Well, you don't get rewarded in a bigger fashion than Peter Callahan and Ken and this Philly. You don't get rewarded in a bigger way than winning an American Classic race. And, you know, speaking of classic, it's funny. I'm anxious to hear this from Ken, because after the race, about a half hour later, I did a segment on one of the Mad Dog channels. And one of the things I kind of floated out there was that between the Alabama performance and this performance, you get the sense that she is, you know, kind of a classic distance type that may just be better off. And Callahan and McPeak have a very tough decision. They've got, you know, free passes to both the distaff and the classic. So that's down the road. That doesn't have to be decided, obviously, for a few weeks. Although we will ask Ken about, you know, how he would adjust training. But even that, this Philly gets trotted out every 4 weeks. It's really a remarkable accomplishment and a remarkable season that is being fashioned. 9 starts, 5 wins, 2 seconds, a third, and only the interestingly, if you go back to the beginning of the year, the only off the board finish was in that 7/8 season kickoff in the Gasparilla. Go figure, right? But everything else has been just super impressive, even in defeat, whether it was second to Art Collector in the Bluegrass or second to She Dares the Devil in the Oaks. Between this and the Alabama, the Santa Anita Oaks, Fantasy, Gulfstream Park Oaks, she's run, they kept reiterating on a regular basis the 9 starts at 9 different racetracks. A fascinating filly. Just not that big, but just hard trying and plucky and in the right spot and employed perfectly by Alborado. The door was left open, and I wanted to make sure, you know, not to talk necessarily about, you know, how the opportunity arose, because Authentic, who ran great, ran a quality race, did not necessarily run as well as he did in the Derby. And did he run as well or not as well, or was he not utilized in the same manner aggressively as he was in the Derby? And got some conflicting, John Velasquez said, you know, that he kind of idled when he took the lead. He got exactly, you know, I kept speculating. Everybody was convinced that it's not a, you know, not patting myself on the back, but it did make sense that there was the opportunity for Authentic to not have to be used hard to get control of the race. And it seems in retrospect, and we're going to talk to Rich Migliori. Rich is at the sale. He's at Timonium, So we'll talk to him at the start of hour three. I want to get his perspective. Joe Bianco's with us, going to be with us too. Hour two, we'll get Joe's take from TDN. Andy Beyer is going to join us shortly here in the next 2 minutes, because I'll explain why I reached out to Andy. Andy regularly has joined us after Triple Crown events, but there's got to be a discussion about whether or not, you know, Johnny didn't take the opportunity to let Authentic roll. You know, once they hit the backstretch, it seemed like a natural to just kind of let him out, and it, not a horse that you rate on the lead. We discussed this, you know, so extensively post Derby. This is a kind of a classic Baffert style, free running, you know, gut 'em like a carp type of a horse, and whereby the Derby was fast early, slow late. This ended up being slow early and fastish late. They went fast. And the top pair did anyway. I mean, they were 10 lengths clear of everybody. And yeah, that really, with Art Collector, who ran okay, did not have a comfortable journey, was kind of pocketed and in amongst and never really had a smooth trip, but ran okay. Jesus' Team, who we talked about all week leading in, and ran huge. That was great for Jose DeAngelo. We'll break all that down. And when we talk about the speed, perfect timing to bring in Andy Beyer, because this was a fast Preakness, quote unquote. And at the same time, in proximity to the stake record, but of course this race is being run in October as opposed to May, so we've talked about this all summer. The development curve is different, but more importantly, track speed. Andy, good morning, first of all.
Good morning, Steve. Go right ahead.
Well, I had to reach out to you first, because when everybody was talking about how close this was to the Preakness record, and then when the fig came out yesterday morning, people were like, oh, that fig's so low. It's like, oh, my God. All right, let's explain it again.
Okay. when I first looked at this race, looked at the results, I thought it was going to be just apart from the final time, I mean, the way the race developed, I thought this was going to be a very big figure, because when giant figure races are often characterized by big gaps in the field, and the fact that Swiss Skydiver and Authentic were nearly 10 lengths ahead of everybody else, suggested that they really ran huge. I mean, in a race like, in some run-of-the-mill races, you could say, well, everybody ran lousy. In a million-dollar race that all the trainers are pointing for, you don't expect everyone to go off form. I mean, if this had just been a standalone race, we just had to make a figure on the basis of that. I mean, I certainly would have made it. I thought it would be 110 or thereabouts. But we have a perfect barometer on which to make a true speed figure. And that barometer was the Black Eyed Susan Stakes, run the race immediately, before the Preakness. It was the only other route race on the card. And this by any kind of standards was really weak, a weak field for a grade two race. I mean, an allowance filly won it. You her lifetime best had been a 91. And as we looked at this, as I looked at this race, I knew what the figure had to be within a point or so. A 91 or 92 would be consistent with kind of most all of the horses in the field. The only exception being the runner-up, Bonnie South, who had a real bad trip on Saturday. So the 92 fit with everybody else. Yet this weak field getting a low figure produced like the third fastest Black-Eyed Susan time since the distance was changed to a mile and an eighth in 1989. So obviously the track was super fast. And the raw figure that they ran of 148.08 was roughly 10 points slower than the raw figure in the Preakness. So there was no way to give the Preakness a big number. We considered that the pace was a little on the slow side, which might have retarded these horses from running quite as fast as they could. So we just on that basis, we nudged the number up, by a couple points, but 105, I couldn't go more than a 105. Based on the hard evidence of how fast the horses ran.
When I saw the number, it seemed immediately to make perfect sense. I mean, Swiss Skydiver, when she won the Alabama at a mile and a quarter, and I want to ask you the same question I'm going to ask Kenny, who's going to join us next. She ran a 102 going the mile and a quarter, and of course, Authentic had come off the 105 in the Derby, so he paired up. I also thought you had a very easy third place horse to work a number from as well in Jesus's team, who's been running 90, 92, 95. The number just worked up and down the chart.
Yeah, well, not all the way, because you had horses like Art Collector and Max Player who didn't run nearly the races that you would have expected of them. I mean, there were two of the also rans that I was watching closely, because I had a matchup bet with Mr. Big News over 1,000 words, and I didn't like 1,000 words, but at all. But like after a half a mile, 1,000 words was just a dead horse, and Mr. Big News, even with 1,000 words obviously going nowhere, Mr. Big News was struggling to keep up with him. So there were some horses in this race who really did run lousy, but at any rate, I don't think the top two have anything to apologize for. They ran terrific races. I mean, Swiss Skydiver ran her heart out. The figure of 105 is certainly respectable, and I mean, I thought it was regardless of the figure, I thought it was a worthy and dramatic end to what I thought was a very good Triple Crown series.
I completely agree, and in fact, we can kind of transition this into kind of an overview as well as of the Triple Crown season, a recap and also in anticipation of the Breeders' Cup. But one note, getting back to the pace for a second, 24-2, 47-3, 111-1, and it says a lot that the three of the closers that you would have expected to benefit from any pace, Max Player, Accession, and Mr. Big News, they finished 5th, 6th, and 7th, and there just was no pace to run into. And from that standpoint, Julian Toledo on Jesus' team, he moved cleverly, and then of course Robbie Alvarado, moving when he did to basically seize control of the race, and from that point she wasn't letting the Derby winner by.
The part of the pace line that really impresses me was the fourth quarter in 23:50. Mm. I mean, here are horses running sub 24 quarters is a real mark of excellence, in distance races on the dirt. You don't see it very often. And the fact that these two horses accelerated like that was really impressive. I mean, I thought they were, you could say, yeah, they benefited from the slow pace, but boy, plenty of horses benefit from slow paces without having that much in the tank. So I salute them both.
Let me also get back to that 10 furlong question. It really feels, Andy, at this point, and I'm going to let Kenny opine on this, that this filly, who doesn't really seem bred for a classic trip, the daredevil out of a Johannesburg mare, it does feel like she's an authentic 10 furlong horse and excels at 10 furlongs.
Well, I think she, certainly a 9.5 furlongs is she's
close enough.
Darn good. I'd be very interesting to see, what she does going forward. But I love it when you have good fillies and mares like this, and the owners and trainers give them a shot against males. I mean, there are just too many. You see too many fillies who get, oh, this is one of the best horses in the land, and she could beat males, and that. But they don't. But so many owners and trainers won't run them and prove it. And you look at the speed figures on many acclaimed fillies. They just don't match up against the boys, and it's all hype. But they really stepped out and took a shot, and I'm glad to see somebody rewarded for their boldness.
Exactly. And McPeak has proven that he's not afraid to run a horse that he thinks fits, and he's upset races in big spots and shared. You think about the Travers Dead Heat and Sarava, and he's certainly has had his share, and he's. He's also taken horses to Europe, and he thinks about Ascot and so forth. I mean, he's very willing to, some people interpret it as kind of grandiose, it's a sport that has the capability of really rewarding that approach, and that's the case where we are here. Andy, looking ahead over these next 4 weeks, all things considered, Breeders' Cup is shaping up to be really good, and a lot of categories that were fairly amorphic early in the year have taken shape, and it feels like we're in for some good matchups in most of the divisions.
Yeah, I'm 'tis the laws, Belmont, was a figure of 109 that certainly, suggests that, he is going to be very competitive against whoever they throw at him. And, I think one of the things that's always been fun about the racing season and the Triple Crown is that you know the three-year-olds run against each other, and then you want to see them get the acid test against older horses and see how good they really are. So I think this is a moment for Tis the Law, and I guess they would probably run authentic in the classic, though with a horse with that much speed, they certainly have some options. And and speaking of speed and speed figures, there were a couple other really notable races over the weekend. The Kelso Handicap at Belmont, I mean, the Chad Brown horse Complexity ran a figure of 110, which is going to make him certainly a Breeders' Cup factor. I mean, it was a field of four. He was the speed of the race, so you can say he really had a soft setup. But he really motored at the end, and this was a horse who always had a lot of ability from the start. He won the Champagne at two, and now he's achieved his potential. He's going to be a factor. And speaking of factors, we had at Pimlico, it may not have gotten much notice, but the fastest turf figure of the year was recorded by Factor This in that Grade Two Stakes on the Pimlico card. I mean, he got a figure of 110. The course was very soft that day, and if you just look at scan the results charts, he just ran much, much faster than everybody else. If making figures on soft turf can often be a little tricky because you just have so many horses in the fields who just may not like the going. But any way you looked at this, it was a monster performance. I mean, one of many by Brad Cox horses over the weekend.
You also, on the same front, got to mention, and then I'll go through, after Ken joins us, I'll go through the whole weekend and hit a lot of the highlights, but certainly on the mile division, you had the performance of Mo Forza, who continues to really just... I can't gush enough about what this means when it comes to Barry Abrams. And Mo Forza came back, wins the City of Hope Mile, gets a 106. And then the upset, Paulo Lobo, who we've enjoyed since the days of Farda Amiga, the wonderful mare that he brought to this country. And here's another Brazilian Grade One winner for Lobo, Ivar, who I went back and looked, and I still would have been hard-pressed to utilize Ivar, but 104 for him. So there were some very notable figs all over the country, really.
Yeah, it's not surprising that so many horses ran big races at around this time, because for much of the season, because of the virus, I don't think, and because the uncertainties of what the racing schedule was going to be like, horses weren't getting revved up. I mean, we talked, I think, on an earlier broadcast about the 2-year-old races, at top tracks were producing figures like in the 40s and 50s, it made me think, God, has something gone haywire with the numbers? But it was that nobody was really revved up because there was, really not an incentive to do it. So I think, now the American horse population is, you know, has gotten fit, and I hope we finish the season with a bang in the Breeders' Cup.
Well, it seems to be headed that way, and I'll also include the Joe Hirsch win by Channel Maker, who also, as a veteran, continues to improve almost, if that's appropriate, a 108 winning the Joe Hirsch Turf Classic. Bill Mott with a big weekend, not just at Belmont. Bill, I mean, fired up in Kentucky and elsewhere. So, Andy, I really appreciate this because I saw the confusion, the public not understanding why a near record time didn't equate to to a gigantic figure. And so,
I mean, I think if people just look at the final time of the Black-Eyed Susan and look at the final time, of the Preakness, and, a 16th of a mile is worth like 6 2/5 seconds, and then compare them, and you'll see that Swiss Skydiver was not significantly faster than an ordinary group of three-year-old fillies, so it's not a mystery.
It just seems that way.
Right.
Andy Beyer, and the more people try to work and understand this, the easier it becomes. Andy, thank you so much.
Okay, I'll talk to you before the Breeders' Cup, I imagine.
Without fail,
you got it. Bye-bye.
Andy Beyer, everybody. And I had to kick off with this because there was obviously that confusion out there yesterday morning. People were like, oh, that fig's too low. It seems low. It's like, no, it doesn't. It seems to be completely logical. So you're treated to an early visit from Andy. Well, usually he's either first or second on post-classic days. Ken McPeak is going to join us momentarily, and we'll kind of celebrate this this win. It deserves it. I mean, absolutely deserves that acknowledgement for McPeak, who, at different times during my inclination is to say spring, but during the summer and as we headed toward Derby, he was being, he wasn't even being circumspect. I mean, he was sort of publicly considering running the filly in the Derby. And, it's certainly easy for people that, after the fact to say, well, she might have beaten them in the Derby. That's neither. you can speculate all you want on that. I really hadn't even thought much about it until, just mentioning it here. But there's quite a bit that went on in this race that, and as Andy was talking about, the matchup, and I looked down and I saw 1,000 words behind Mr. Big News, and then I saw that the horses that were 9th, 10th, and 11th through the half mile, and almost through the three quarter, they ended up 5th, 6th, and 7th. I mean, there was just no place for the closers to go, because by the time they make their move, Swiss Skydiver and Authentic are gone. That's why the two of them are 10 lengths ahead of Jesus's Team and Art Collector, and 12, 13, 14 lengths ahead of the 5th, 6th, 7th finishers. Ken McPeak joins us, and we've certainly over the years had plenty of opportunities to congratulate Ken on big wins, but in a lot of ways this feels like one of the biggest. Kenny, congratulations to you, Peter, Robbie Alvarado, and this this absolutely throwback filly.
Yeah, she's amazing to be around. We've asked a lot of her, and she just keeps going, and just really proud of her. And job Robbie did. It's been a surreal weekend.
The decision making process, and while we were waiting for you, I kind of ticked back to pre Derby, and then of course there was also the Bluegrass as well, where you took a shot and figured let's get points, and it made a lot of sense doing what you did. Talk about the decision-making process with her and what you've learned along the way that gave you the confidence to run here Saturday.
Well, we relied on the sheets to analyze how she fit on paper. And, look, it's not like, if you go back to our Saraba win, he didn't hardly fit on paper, I don't suppose, but she did. And, you get a little bit of weight off when you're running against the Colts, and she'd accomplished so much against fillies this year already, and we just really felt like that of the lesser of the evils was the Preakness, because it's such a great race, and to take on older fillies and mares, I think you saw There's the Devil got beaten yesterday. So if I had, let's say, I got beaten that race, then it would have been, who knows? But the fact that she got to run against straight three-year-olds, I thought, was just a better setup, and the added distance.
I'm gonna jump to that actually, and instead of using it as a follow-up, because I kind of speculated on that during a recap that I did on Sirius Saturday night. And because the question came up, where does she go now, distaff or classic? And I did say, Kenny, and I saw you had said the same thing. And I just said it to Andy Beyer. Her two best performances from that viewpoint are at 10 furlongs and 9.5. It really feels like she's a natural classic distance horse.
Yeah, I do think she likes the added distance. But you know what? We will analyze the competition and try to figure out where we think she fits best. And we've got plenty of time to sort through all that. And I do like the mile and a quarter, but it's going to depend on who all's in there, and we'll do the math on all that, and Peter and I'll put our heads together and figure it out, and we've got plenty of time.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that made this as special as it turned out, and part of it, frankly, is the Robbie Alborado sidebar, because as if you hadn't already, had people saying, why isn't he running in the Spinster? Why is he running Preakness? And then, in terms of eyebrow raising, tabbing Robbie to ride, brought out, its share of boo birds and eye rolling. Talk about bringing Robbie in.
Well, I suppose you want the whole story. When we ran in the Alabama, we couldn't bring up Brian Hernandez because of COVID. And so Tyler Gaffleone had the ride in Alabama, and it looked like it was just going to be a one race off deal. And he did break her maiden, by the way. But the Peter and I discussed talking to Brian Hernandez about a two race commitment, because we had all the whole time been thinking Oaks, Preakness. And we really felt like we could win the Oaks, and that should be a race. So we offered the two-race commitment to Brian, and Brian and his agent initially turned it down, saying that they couldn't because they had Art Collector, and we understood that. So we offered the two-race commitment to Tyler Gaffleone and his agent, and they accepted it. So we were like, okay, great. So we run in the Oaks, and I do think Tyler should have stayed inside, and we probably win the Oaks that day, but that's nothing that we could control in hindsight. So, but it was his mouth to come back in the Preakness, and we had a two-race commitment in our minds. But I didn't want to commit to the Preakness until – I really didn't want to add Tisdall to the mix because I felt like his race in the Alabama and had such, he's such a good horse, and I don't think that horse is fond of Churchill. That's just my opinion. I may be wrong, but anyway, when Tisdall, that he didn't come out until or announce he was out. I want to say till the 23rd or 24th, maybe even later. So I had to. Okay, at that point, it's okay. Now we're going to seriously consider it. But I was in the middle of the Keeneland sale, and that's such a marathon. And I had told Tyler's agent, look, I need to get out of this sale and get over to Churchill and watch her train for a couple, 3 days, and we're going to work her on Saturday. Tyler's going to come work her, and if she works well, then we will sort it out. So Tyler comes over and works her, and she worked like a beast. I mean, she worked fantastic, jumped off, it's the best she's ever felt. You know, let's go, let's do it. Okay, great. Saturday, so I announced that we're running in the Preakness, and Peter and I concurred, and Saturday night I'm told that Tyler can't ride. I said, well, we enter in 36 hours. How can you tell me this now? We have a two-race commitment. Well, we're riding for Chad Brown at Keeneland. And I'm like, well, you know, that's just dishonorable. You can't put me in this position. I have zero options right now. What am I going to do? And they just basically said, it's your problem. So I reached out to Mike Smith's agent. I reached out to Corey Landry's agent. We tried to do the math on who was available, even local riders in Maryland. And I told Peter, I said, I got an idea here, and I don't know if we can get any of these guys, but Robbie's been breezing horses for me at Keeneland, and I think he's on his game, and he's been there, done that, and we need somebody that's freed up that weekend to be able to go. And he said, well, he's not been riding a lot right now. I said, I don't know, but he's on his game. Believe me, he's working hard. He'd been breezing young horses for me. And I said, yeah, you know what? As far as I'm concerned, I have complete confidence Robbie could get this done. But what I'm going to require is, well, one, we needed to see if Smith was available, so we had to wait till Sunday. So we didn't find that out till Sunday afternoon that Smith wasn't available. And I called Robbie and I said, here's a series of events that have to happen for you to be able to go up and ride her. I'm going to tell Peter I want you to go. And he says, I'm in. No problem. And I said, but you're going to come get on her every day. You're going to get to know her. You're going to, you know, he was already ready to study her races. And I said, and you and I are going to fly up together, and we're going to spend every day with her. And this reminded me of when David Cohen won the Travers for me, and I also asked him to make a bond with this horse, get on him every day, get to know him, be one with him. And Robbie and I got on the plane, and we had dinner, breakfast, lunch, dinner, breakfast, lunch, dinner. He came, got on her first thing in the morning. He'd help hot walk her. He'd help hold her for a bath. I walked her. It was, you know what, even if we had been fourth, it was a great time. And he and I have already, we were friends prior to this, and he's won graded races for me before. But it's quite a happy ending. We really took, I think, a negative and turned it into a positive, and I think you have to do that. And in all cases in life, you have to do that. And it's just surreal. It really is. It's just like, wow, we did it. We did it.
Talk about his decision making and take us around the oval and what you were thinking going in about how close you wanted to be and what you expected of the pace, because when it all came down and they went past the stands, they weren't going nearly as fast as most people expected.
Well, I believe her best race is when she hits 48 seconds for the half mile. I think that saves her enough juice to sprint home, and if you go too quick, then you soften her up a little bit. And she went to the Bluegrass. In the Bluegrass, she went, that half, we went a little slow. And I'm sorry, we went a little quick. And if we paced her a little bit better, I think she could have run down Art Collector. But hindsight 2020. And I think the Alabama race, she hit 48 spot on. And I told Robbie, I said, let her, you know, just get her in rhythm. Don't force anything. If she hits 48, she's going to finish. And if she takes you there without you moving, if you haven't moved, when they straighten up, you're going to win this race. And the best move he made was splitting that hole. And he said she took him right through it. And he had a lot of horse, and she's just really special. Unbelievable.
Talk about the camera got on you pretty quickly post race, but talk about what you were seeing down the stretch, because there were a few strides where it looked like Authentic was getting the shoulder in front, and then in deeper stretch it seemed like she's not going to let him by, and basically held. As the charts will say, held sway.
Well, it did look like he was going to get by at about the 8th pole or closer to the 16th pole. And she just dug back in. You know, Robbie only hit her once. And he said fillies don't need to be hit. And I know there was like a six strike rule or something that Maryland has. And Robbie said he really at no point in time had any intentions of hitting her, because he didn't feel like that she needed to be hit. She already had, and the way that she carries a rider is more important than striking her. And I think that's just he's a quick study. He knows what he's doing. He just hadn't had the stock over the last couple, 3 years. And that comes and goes. And, he certainly deserves to ride more, and I'm certainly going to give him more mounts, and I think others will too.
Just an absolute thriller. They distanced themselves from the pursuers and gave everybody a real treat. And I talked earlier before Beyer joined us, Kenny, and I made the connections of this duel to Curlin and Street Sense in their Preakness, and of course Robbie on Curlin, your association with Curlin, and then there was also shades of Rags to Riches and Curlin weeks later in New York with Philly versus Colt, and so there was some historic overtones, and then there was just the raw thrill of competition, whether it's male female or male.
Well, Billie Jean King would be proud, wouldn't she?
Talk a little bit. We got the filly to talk about at Keeneland, the Grade One win, simply ravishing. She was spectacular, and I don't want to let Envotante go unnoticed as well from last weekend at Remington. But Kenny, talk about the decision-making process, and maybe gird some people toward trying things that are out of the norm, and you've been impervious to criticism as long as anybody's known you. You're going to try things, and you're going to think about some things that other people would, wouldn't try. And talk about that mentality and, having the confidence to try these kinds of gambits.
Well, some people out there have ever read the Eleanor, I believe it was Eleanor Roosevelt, The Critic. You can't really worry about it, The Critic. It is, being in the arena is completely different than being outside and having an opinion. And, you get the glory when it works out. And you got to ignore all the chirping. It doesn't really even matter. I had a life event that happened to me in 1995, 96. I had a misdiagnosed ruptured appendix, and I actually saddled down a run in the Derby with it, and it walled off, and I practiced. I was actually on an operating table in the summer And it's the summer of 96, and they gave me 12 hours to live. And I got off that, I got out of that, and it took me about a month to recover. And I live life differently since then because, you know, everything's gravy, really. The doctor said, you know how close you were to dying? And I said, no clue. And she said, too close. And so when you take that perspective, and, you know, lost my mom years back in 2005 when I took the sabbatical, that was a, my mother was terminal then, you become more aware of, you know, what really matters and what you can do in life, and you shouldn't be fearful. I mean, it's a horse race. It's not a, it's not like it's the end of the world. If you get beat, you just regroup and you move and you learn. And since I think I was an average trainer back then, and I had small vision of I mean, I needed a bigger picture, and I take that approach today. I've never been scared to run a big race. Don't really care whether people agree with me or not. But, you know, I've knocked down enough of them that I've shut them up quite a few times, so I really don't need to worry about that. And my mother would say, the best revenge is winning, son. Just get out there and win. You can't worry about all the other noise. And she was an amazing person. She gave me sage advice on a regular basis. Work hard for those that want you. Don't put too much energy into those that don't. Keep at it. She was really special, and I attribute a lot of the person I am today to my mother. My father, to give him some credit, taught me how to read a pedigree and the passion for horse racing. But my mother is the one that's given me the stability to pursue a lot of things and never be scared to do it.
Well, it pays off, and, you know, the other parts of the equation include, you know, being able to identify young horses as prospects and buy them, buying them right. And, you know, you and I have talked about this, countless times. And I thought it was kind of under discussed or under reported. I mean, the fact that, you know, that she was a modest purchase has, you know, certainly been brought up enough times, but, you know, between the Black Eyed Susan winner, and we'll talk to Jimmy Ryerson next hour, she was an $11,000 purchase, and you know, here's this filly for, you know, for $35,000, and it's inspirational for those of us that are in this game and don't have, you know, big six-figure bankrolls to apply to get bloodstock. And, you know, it obviously, you know, being with people that can, you know, look at a young horse, and of course Timonium starting today, having, you know, having that part of the equation is a big element. But you know, when we see this happen, it gives hope. It should give hope to a lot of people that, you know, that know that they can't compete at the highest level when it comes to what is spent to acquire, you know, a good horse. So from that standpoint, it really goes a long way to make people, you know, believe and you know, have confidence that it can happen to them.
Well, more young trainers need to attend horse sales and learn how to do that. And I don't know. I've evolved in the sense that I wanted better horses, and I would tell my clients, we need better horses. This isn't about who's the smartest trainer. It's sometimes who's got the best stock. And I always say, you know, let me pick them, and if they don't run, it'd be my fault. But if they can run, I'm gonna find one that can. And I don't know, all the years I've done it, you've got to be able to go, whether you're competing against, you know, whether Wayne Lucas has had his year, or Bob, or Todd Pletcher, these guys have so many good horses. So you have to figure a way to how you can outsmart them to be able to get, even if you don't have the budget. And I've got a lot of really great people that I work for. I mean, I can just go on and on and on, the wonderful people you know, Harold Lerner, Scott Leeds, Tommy Lewis, of course, Peter Callahan, and there are more. They just want the good horse. It's not what you spend, it's how you spend it. And you're better off buying from either a quiet family with a horse that's got the body and buy the first stakes winner out of an emerging family than you are becoming, I guess, a pedigree snob where, oh, it's got, the mare's got to throw stakes winner in her first five horses before I'm going to buy it. Crazy. No, I'd rather buy the first stakes winner out of the mare when she hasn't produced one yet, and then I get value. So it's how you spend people's money. So the value buys, whether it was Curlin or her, Simply Ravishing, is, in a way, it's hurt me because sometimes I want to buy a horse for more money, but in a way, it's kept me humble in that, you know, we got to keep doing it with these and producing for good people and spending their money smart.
Talk about Simply Ravishing and Crazy Beautiful, actually, too. 1-2 on Friday in the Alcibiades.
Well, this fellow Simply Ravishing, and I told Harold Lerner a while back, this might be the best horse you've ever owned. And he's had some pretty good ones, as Golden Eskimo Kisses and others. But I told him, I said, you need to calm down because you are going to get your picture taken. We were pretty sure that she's a better filly than Crazy Beautiful, which was already saying a lot. Because Crazy Beautiful is a liquid filly. But we had worked them together, and in all honesty, it was a bit of a mismatch. I hated to run them against each other. And I almost took Crazy Beautiful to the Frisette, but we didn't want to ship. But, Simply Ravishing's got this huge long stride on her. And she's a gorgeous filly. I'm going to tell you right now, she will be nominated to Trip Crown. So so we won't have to supplement like we did with Swiss Skydiver. The future with her is really bright, and hopefully we'll knock down a Breeders' Cup with her.
That is the the logical next question in terms of going forward. I'm just reaching for the there's the chart. We got so much stuff on this lap. It's crazy. There's the Phoenix Alcibiades. There we go. This obviously being a New York bred, Meg Levy bred. Simply Ravishing out of a More Than Ready mare and being by Leia Band. And, how much of this, this angle or this direction, because you're somebody, you and Mark Cassie, I mean, there's a few people we talk to about, the interchangeability of starting horses on turf and moving them to the dirt. And, Mark always talks about, that it's a little easier on them early on, starting with turf. You've talked about that as well. If the P.G. Johnson stays on the turf, do you run in this race or do you take a different direction?
Yeah, absolutely. We had planned all along the Alcibiades was a really great spot for. But for me, it's not about turf. It's about the dynamics of a mile and a 16th. Because if you sprint a horse too many times, their mind becomes a sprinter. And if you route them and you teach them to rate and relax at some point, and there's no forcing anything, and then you focus in on the finish, then horses, I think, they thrive on repetition. And when you run two turns, they've got to figure out how to get in a nice pace and rhythm and not overexert and then rush to the finish fast. And I like to teach my young horses to rate off the pace. Swiss Skydiver learned her lessons in her first race. She came from last and wiggled her way through traffic and drew off. Simply Ravishing was, and there are no two-turn, two-year-old dirt races available at a certain point in time, sure, especially in July and August. And September they start coming around, but then you're already in the middle of, you're getting close in the preps for those 2 year old stakes are already being run, and the fact that it came off the turf in the PG Johnson was I didn't like it, but also felt like she could win anyway, and of course she's so ultra talented. She went on and just ran off, but you know, the Alcibiades has been the goal for a long time, and I always kid Wayne Lucas, and he's a good friend of mine. I really love the man. I've told him, I said, I will win more Alcibiades than you. he's a really competitive guy, too. And I remember years ago when I won my first Belmont, I ran into Wayne the next morning, and we were going to the track and coming out of the elevator. He said, 13-1. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, well, I've got 13 Triple Crown wins, and you've only got one. And I said, well, Wayne, I think the math's 67-39. And he's like, well, what's that mean? I said, you're 67, and I'm only 39. He laughed. We've always been friends since then. But I love the Alcibiades. It's a great race. And, you know, I'd like to get a Breeders' Cup under my belt. Those things have been frustrating, but we'll get there.
We'll worry about that in a few weeks. And, of course, you know, getting the win over the surface and even getting the runner-up finish for Crazy Beautiful goes a long way. Let's fold in another filly, because I did tell you earlier that I wasn't going to let Envitante's performance at Remington go unnoticed. She's sort of been playing not second fiddle, because you've had nice things to say about her, you know, all year long. Talk about where you are with her coming out of the Remington Oaks win.
She's probably got some time on the shelf. I think earlier in the season we got pretty ambitious with her between the Ashland and the Alabama. And I was glad to see that she got the third in the grade one in the Ashland. That was good. And, you know, been asked recently about your win percentage. I don't worry about win percentage. I worry about your black type on fillies, and that's one filly that we chased some black type with, because we knew she was a good filly, but we also knew that she wasn't quite as good as Swiss, which has been proven pretty well. But she's certainly not chopped liver, and I could have earlier in the year maybe gone to the Iowa Oaks, she would have won that. I could have gone to Delaware Oaks, she probably would have won that. But we chose to chase some of the bigger prizes. And then the Remington race, I was in between it and the Black Eyed Susan. I do think she could have won the Black Eyed Susan too. But we wanted to check the graded stakes box with her because of the long-term residual value. We actually took a shot with two other fillies in the race just to see if they could hit the board, because, like I said, the residual value is a big deal for breeders, and certainly the owner of the horse currently, it gives some resale value for sure if you ever choose to.
Well, I guess we'll wait and look forward to a return. You know, she's an Uncle Mo out of Bluegrass Catmare and Chant Enchanté.
I think we won't see her till she's till next year. Right now, I don't think there's any 3-year-old filly races on dirt. We did nominate her to the Valley View, but that would be a main track only entry, and I'm not sure I'm going to even enter in there. And then, like I said, I got to look at the calendar. I just got back from Baltimore, but I think she's probably going to get a break, and we'll regroup and bring her back in some 4-year-old grade threes or list of stakes, stuff like that.
Excellent. Well, Kenny, one more round of Philly conversation, and that is in regard to Wednesday. May have to call you again later in the week. Talk about the Phillies and the Jessamine.
Sounds good. We've got a decent shot there, too.
Lazy Summer Day. This is Fern Circle and Brary Jones, and a homebred of Brary's, Summerfront Philly. Out of a Gone West mare that broker maiden at Ellis, going the mile in the 16th, and she's, you know, at Churchill. She drew outside, but it looks like she, you know, might come from a little bit off anyway.
It's a good next step for her. you know, another win and you're in. And she's a good filly, big, beautiful filly. And she actually, I think she's going to be a better older horse than even two-year-olds. So time's in front of us here, and we've got we're going to see what she's made of. She's certainly going to have to run hard, but it's a good next step for her.
And then on Thursday, let me ask you about the first-time starter, the exaggerator filly of Lee Pacoy's Wild Story.
We're still trying to figure where she fits. I think she'll like the turf, and she's certainly prepared to get the distance there. But she's a beautiful filly, Saratoga yearling purchase. And, looking forward to her first run.
Well, we talked about a whole bunch of fillies, too, and three-year-olds, but a classic winner, historic, the sixth filly to win a Preakness, and Kenny will look forward to the postscript here and the reporting with the decision-making. Congratulations to Peter and Robbie, you, the whole team, because it is, you know, you run a team operation. Just, you know, really special and a great way to end the Triple Crown season.
Thanks, Steve.
Ken McPeak, everybody, and you follow Kenny on Twitter, Kenny McPeak, and you know, Kenny put up a wonderful video yesterday morning greeting her at the stall, and she's bounced out of it. So all good, and really a special chapter here to the end of the Triple Crown season. A little bit past the top of the hour after Kenny McPeak and Andy Byard joined us. Let's take a break here. When we come back, I've got Joe Bianca is going to join us from TDN. We've got visits coming up with Jimmy Ryerson, who won the Black Eyed Susan, one of our favorite horsemen anywhere. Ryerson does such a great job and been a while between graded stake wins. So we'll talk to Jimmy and Damon Dillodovico as well, because Lackey, I haven't even mentioned this yet. That was one of the most fun wins of the weekend. Damon, you know, who's won his share of regional stakes and Maryland mid-Atlantic type things. But you'll remember he had Immortal Eyes. And he won a DeFrancis Dash with Immortal Eyes, but it wasn't graded at that moment. It was that period early in the decade when Maryland racing was, you know, kind of laying there like a goldfish that jumped out of the bowl. And so he didn't have a graded stake win in what has been a very good, consistent career. So just thrilled. And you know, how do you not get excited about seven-year-old Lackey? We'll talk to Damon later. We've got Mig from the sale. And we got more. So we'll have more for the next, like, 3 days. There's so much going on here. There's so much to recap. Jay Pridman will join us tomorrow, too. And Andy, of course, have to dig into all of the New York results. And, oh, my God, Santa Anita. I did mention Mo Forza, who, you know, kind of a house horse in terms of roots for Barry Abrams. Got to get to Peter Miller, actually. I'm going to reach out to Peter. Maybe we'll get Peter in hour three because he's had two tremendous weekends in a row. Mo Forza, and he had the Zuma Beach winner yesterday, that Ibico. And last week he won three of the Santa Anita Stakes, including the American Pharaoh and for Gary Barber and CZ Rocket, who won the Sprint Championship. So, you know what? We'll reach out for Peter. Let's take a break. Joe Bianca from TDN next. He won't be on Zoom, so nobody can critique the, you know, the decor of his apartment. Back after this with Joey.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
From BRL Equine, the people that bring you EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Shield, now comes Flexify HA, the most advanced, scientifically based joint supplement on the market. To find out more, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880. To be the best, give them only the best. BRL Equine.
Our Pennsylvania breeding program was, of course, impacted by the pandemic. Now, with our country getting back to work, we'd like to again talk about our program, the best in North America. Our breeder awards will remain up to 50% for PA-sired PA breds. Owner bonuses will also stay at up to 40%. Restricted races will again be run at all three PA tracks, and PA Day at the races will return. I'm Brian Sanfratello. For more, please visit PABred.com.
Sirius XM Sports presents... The Races with Steve.